I'm going to start and bring to order the House Joint and with the Senate Transportation Committee meeting. And it is about 4 minutes after 1. And I just want to announce that the following House members are present. And first of all, Representative Johnson is in a leadership meeting, which I left in order to get here. They're still going. Vice Chair Isaacson he has a bill in another committee, and so does Representative Lynn. So as soon as their bills are heard, they'll be down here. And then we have Representative Gaddis, and and myself, Representative Wilson, and Senator Egan. I would have you go ahead and introduce your Senate members.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Vice Chair Senator Dyson, Committee Member Senator Bishop, and myself, Senator Egan.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry, and Senator Faircloth. Sorry.
No. I would like to recognize our staff today. We have Nancy Hemingway over here. She's our recording secretary. And on this side is Donna, who is our moderator. And my committee aide is Becky Rooney. So before we start, if you would turn your phones to airplane mode. That way they're off and not interfering with our IT system here. So today we'll be hearing from DOT on airport funding, the challenges, and the surface transportation funding. And also, in addition to those, I've asked DOT to present us with a STIP explanation, because if that's something that it's hard for us to understand as legislators, and we thought that it would be good for the people that are listening out in TV land so that they would have an idea also what the situation was. So we have a lot of ground to cover, and so I'm asking everyone to hold their questions till the end of the presentation, and then we'll ask questions. And so we'll let our commissioner go ahead, Commissioner of DOT, Pat Kemp. Would you like to, I'll let him start, and we'll proceed from there.
Okay, well, we'll move real quick, Madam Chairman. John Binder should be on the phone, and we can get right into our AIP program, our aviation program, right away. And we'll run the slides from here.
Okay, and you all have slides that go along with this in your packet. And John is online, and he is going to go through the presentation with us. So, John, go ahead.
For the record, Deputy Commissioner John Binder, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
And just
giving the airport overview.
John, just before, we just had Representative Feige join us, so I wanted to mention that before you got started. So go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
No problem. Thank you. First slide should be the Airport Improvement Program, or the AIP program, that provides the federal funding to both our international system and our rural airport system. This slide is primarily just intended to show you some of the formulas and how those break down in rough average amounts over the last several years. Typically, our AIP federal receipts run around the $210 million per year. You see last year a pretty significant drop in that number. The way the Fed arrives at those numbers, starting off with cargo entitlements, and that just depends on how much cargo runs through our international system. Obviously, the more cargo we have, the more funding we get. Primary passenger entitlements includes those airports that are greater than 10,000 passenger enplanements each year. So that includes both Fairbanks and Anchorage International, as well as our 17 primary certificated airports in our rural system as well. The non-primary entitlements are for all of those airports that do not reach the 10,000 threshold. State apportionment is just a formula that the federal government uses based on land area and population to come up with a certain number for each state in the country. Alaska's apportionment tends to be pretty constant there, around $21 million. The Alaska supplement is something that's based on legislature back from 1980 amounts, and that typically averages around the $21 million. That'll bump up or down a little bit each year, depending on how much is given to municipalities for those that run their own airports as well, so the non-DOT-owned. And lastly is this discretionary. The overall AIP budget each year is typically about $3.2 billion. That's what the FAA distributes among the various states. Once they run through all those formula amounts for each state, they have a chunk left over, and that's up to their discretion to distribute as desired based on what they feel the primary or the priority projects are across the country. Next slide. Next slide should just indicate the funding over the last 3 years, just kind of an example of where we've been and hopefully where we will be in the future. The current authorization bill in Congress, or that has passed, did fully fund AIP this year, so we would be hopeful that we'd be back up to our FY 11 and 12 numbers, so 200 to 210 million or so, but that will be remain to be seen. Next slide. We were also asked just to give a quick overview on our APEB process, or the Airport Project Evaluation Board. It's a prioritization system that the state uses. It's in line with the FAA guidelines as well that they use for their national system. The board is composed of myself as deputy commissioner, the three regional directors, our maintenance and operations chief, and our director of program development, Jeff Otteson. Board meets as required. Once we get enough projects developed that are ready to go into further development, when they're reached in the scoring process, this board will get together and go through a scoring process. In order for a project to come before the board, it's based on a needs list that gets developed by the respective regions. They determine what is the highest priority projects in their region, and they further develop those projects. And then their planning teams are the ones that present those nominations to the board, arguing for scoring. There's a variety of criteria used for the scoring, depending on what type of project it is. Most of our projects are obviously airport projects. We do break that down further into pavement-type projects or buildings or whatnot. For buildings, we do use a separate criteria and then realize there are some projects that do not actually get scored that are lesser projects. Regularly review all of these projects in the list we've developed, confirming that priorities haven't changed or dollar amounts, additional costs and considerations that we hadn't thought of in the past are still applicable. And once all those projects are scored, then our planning team goes back and develops our spending plan for the next several years based on anticipated federal and state capital funding and overall priorities. Spending plans constantly under review as those funding amounts change or different priorities come up, whether that's based on legislature or the governor or natural disasters. A lot of things factor into that spending plan. So that's constantly in flux, but we keep working at trying to keep it as stable as possible. And that completes the airport presentation.
Okay. Thank you very much, John. And do I have any questions? Senator Egan.
No big deal, Madam Chair. On Alaska Supplemental, on that page, you're talking about 1980 amounts. Are we still referring to 1980 when you do your scoring?
Through the chair, for Senator Egan, I'm going to pass this one off to our AIP manager, Roger Maggard, here from Statewide Aviation.
The through the chairs, Representative Egan.
Can you get a little closer to the microphone because we can't hear you very well?
Through the chair, Representative Egan. The 1980 amount was set in legislation at the behest, I believe, of Senator Stevens. And that number is essentially constant. It is defined in the U.S. Code as a given amount at approximately $21 million. So that money comes directly to through the FAA and is used for all airports within the state of Alaska, with the exception of the international system.
So,
Senator Egan.
No big deal. Thank you, Madam Chair. To follow up, so municipal airports like Juneau and Kenai don't go into the scoring?
That, through the chair, Senator Egan, you are correct. They negotiate directly with the FAA. They do not go through our scoring system.
Great, thank you.
John, I have a question, and that is, if we didn't have that legislative amount in the federal statutes, I guess what you would call it, I'm not sure what I want. Anyway, if that wasn't there, would it be possible that by now we would be getting less than we are getting?
Yes, that is correct. Were that not there, very likely that Alaska's portion of federal funding would be a lesser amount.
Yeah. Thank you. I've had a feeling that that was the reason it was put there. Any other questions? Senator Egan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for you, John. Can you get a little more detail on project scoring?
Chair to Senator Egan. Absolutely. The scoring, the criteria used for airport projects, we've got 16 different criteria there, and it includes a variety of things, and the weighting is varied as well based on the importance of those. For instance, some of the things we consider are safety, which is obviously weighted very high, maintenance operations, certification to meet FAA requirements. So some of those are the highest weighting. We also include things like health and quality to the community, economic benefits, the community support, and that includes overall support opinion-wise as well as funding, whether there's alternative transportation into that location as well. What the surface condition is if it's a reconstruction type project where it's in bad shape, then obviously that's going to rank higher than something that's in reasonable shape. Does that get to the thrust of your question, sir?
Yeah, that answered a lot of it. But on the slide, it talks about criterion for airports 16 and then buildings 8. What does that mean?
Correct. Through the chair, Senator Egan, we actually have a different set of criteria that we apply to buildings, just because a lot of the ones for the airports don't necessarily apply. But it is a similar process. So for the building criteria, there is safety of the current structure, what the needs are for the airport, whether there's structures already there that serve some of the same purpose, or if this is a new structure. Conditions, weather impacts, land ownership status, how difficult it's going to be to acquire land if required, or whether the airport already owns the land, some of those kind of factors.
So just one follow-up, Madam Chair, and then I'll...
Go ahead, Senator.
So a snow removal equipment facility that would get all those millions of dollars worth of snow removal equipment housed inside, that would be less scoring value than the runway itself?
To the chair, to Senator Egan, not so much a less scoring value, but that different criteria are being used to score that. It still comes up with a valid score that ranks on the overall structure. It's just being used, different criteria is being used to arrive at that score for a building.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Representative Faircloth, Senator Faircloth has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell me for those airports that aren't included in that formula and that are vying for federal dollars, if there's a threshold that makes that happen and why the current program is limited in the current manner that it is?
Through the chair to Senator Faircloth, there are not dollar values associated that determine whether or not they are included in the priority system. Just because of the elements involved in developing these projects that exist within DOT, we have only applied the prioritization process to state-owned airports. In general, those municipalities prefer to interact directly with the FAA versus working through the DOT system.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you very much and for the presentation, and I don't see any other questions. So I do want to note that Representative Grice Tompkins has joined us, and now let's go ahead and move on to our presentation on MAP 21.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeff Otteson. I'm the Director of Program Development at DOT, and it's my division that's responsible for the Federal Highway Program and the STIP process that selects projects therein. So we have a first presentation is on the federal funding, the changes in funding that are going on right now in that program, and the policy changes that were embedded in the law as well. So we'll talk a little bit about the historical funding just to give you context, and then we'll move into the MAP 21, as it's known, moving ahead for progress in the 21st century highway reauthorization. So this chart here illustrates that for 10 years, our funding level has been relatively stable. The obvious exception was in 2009, that large purple spike. That was the ERAS funding, the stimulus funding, as it came to be known, when the state got an extra $175 million. But prior to and before that point in time, we were averaging just about $475 plus or minus over many years. The other thing you'll note there is the earmark era that began in 2005. The earmarks are shown in red. They take up almost half of our funding stream through 2009. And then they began to dwindle down to where last year we had no earmarks whatsoever received. And so there has been debate over the years about whether earmarks came at the expense of our other formula dollars. I'm here to tell you they did. There's no doubt about it, and this chart really illustrates that. So this is the state capital program, in primarily GF, sometimes in GO bonds. Name projects in some cases, more general purpose project accounts such as Connect Anchorage, where they didn't specify the exact road, but it was to be spent in Anchorage, those kinds of funding, and then roads to resources. You can see that money has varied by, you know, a great deal, 10 or 12 or more between the small years and the big years. And we're 14 was definitely down from 13, and I think the 15 request is substantially less than 14. So just to give you some idea how that has varied. This is money we received over the past several years for deferred maintenance. This is actually going to most of the modes. So there's money here for marine highways, harbors, airports, highways, and facilities. It has been relatively stable beginning in fiscal year 11. So now moving into the MAP 21 highway reauthorization, when it was passed 2 years ago, it was a two-year highway and transit bill for the federal years 2013 and 2014. It relied on general fund appropriations and other funding transfers to provide enough funding to basically match that funding I showed you in the first slide with the bar chart, that roughly just under $500 million a year. So for in order for Congress to keep spending at approximately the same level as really the previous decade, they had to find funding and add it to the Highway Trust Fund. Prior to about 6 or 7 years ago, there was no need to add funding to the Highway Trust Fund. It was self-sustaining. In fact, in going back 20 years, the Highway Trust Fund was producing surpluses and was actually lending money to other programs in the federal budget. That is no longer the case. It is now underachieving in terms of revenue. to maintain a steady level of spending. It also, MAP 21, had significant new policies, including some streamlining of difficult federal processes. One thing to understand is this bill will expire in about 8 months. We're already well into the second year. As you'll see here in a minute, there's a lot of uncertainty facing all the states as we go into that federal year 15. This is kind of what we call the, you know, stepping off the cliff chart. This has actually been updated as of just last week, so it's very current information. I don't really think this is going to come about. I don't think this will be our future, but it certainly makes you sort of sit up and take notice. What they're showing is that in 2015, states could expect their funding to drop by nearly 100%. And it's hard to understand just exactly what would make that happen, because you think about the program, it's producing revenue every year. But the simple explanation is that the, see if I have that slide here. I apologize. I think I ended up with two slide presentations that got a little bit mixed up, and I'm not sure I had the right one sent to Connie. But here's the simple explanation. When we obligate funds for a project, we don't actually get the dollars at the point of obligation. What we have is a promise from the federal government to reimburse us as we expend funds. So we bill them as we expend funds, be that on a payroll or on a consultant billing or on a contractor billing. And a typical federal project can take several years to be constructed. So what's happening is the funding's dropping by about 25% in real numbers, but the other 75% is going to be used to pay off the bills from prior years. So it leaves us no capacity if they don't solve this problem going forward. So the MAP 21, the funding level overall was down from about $520 million in 2012 to roughly $484 million. So it went down a little bit, roughly 10%. I did some checking. All other states felt that same drop at the same percentage. There was transit funding at $43 million. About 12 of that $43 million comes to the state of Alaska directly. The rest of it goes to AMATS, FMATS, and also the Alaska Railroad. In addition to the $43 million, there was a new ferry formula that was established, and the Marine Highways receives approximately $17 million out of that program. And we are the net largest recipient from that formula. They significantly streamlined the funding categories. They created fewer categories, but with broader eligibility. The programs that got the most money is by far was the National Highway System and also the Highway Safety Program. Almost every other category in the bill received less funding, and we'll talk a little bit more about what that means. Basically, MAP 21 has redefined the federal interest to be focused on the interstate and national highway system routes. It also added mileage to each state, all principal arterials, a classification known as the functional classification, became automatically a part of the national highway system. So for us, it only added about 4% to the overall national highway system, where it grew by about 4%. But what happened was, these are probably some of the most expensive roads in the state. They tend to be 4- and 6-lane highways, primarily found in Anchorage, very expensive right-of-way, very expensive utilities, very expensive traffic control. Everything about that makes a highway project expensive is found on this on these 90 miles of road. There was a few miles added in Fairbanks, also a few miles added in Matsuboro, and just a very, very small amount of mileage added in Juneau. So about, I think close to 80 miles out of 90 were added in Anchorage. So our national highway system is getting about 57% of the funding out of the overall program. 26% is focused on our lower tier roads. 7% was funded to safety, and then 5% also comes out of those first two categories through what are called sanctions. And then the last 5% is sent off to several different minor categories. For example, there's one for urban planning that's used by the MPOs, AMETs and FMETs. There's money reserved, a small slice of money reserved for bridges and a few other categories. This kind of just shows you in simple terms, if you look at the blue pie on either chart, on the left chart, that blue slice represents the funding to the National Highway System, and on the right-hand chart, the blue slice shows you the miles of road that are eligible for that funding. So you can see that the smallest chart on the right is getting the biggest slice of funding on the left. The red slice is the STP funding. This is money being used by the local road needs around the state. It's also money being used by what is called the Alaska Highway system. Alaska highways are routes that are typically a state highway, typically connecting communities, but they never rose to the level to make them a part of the national highway system. So just an example here, almost all the highways in Prince of Wales, the Denali Highway, much of the Steese and Elliott, once you're off of the route to Prudhoe Bay, all those are part of this Alaska highway system, also competing with these local roads. So our STP funds, which is that category I just mentioned, is further subdivided into a number of other slices. The one at the top, the small blue slice, is funding for bridges that are part of the STP eligible roads. The problem with that amount of money, a little less than $4 million, is it cost us about $8 million to inspect the bridges on that same system. So this is not even enough money to do the bridge inspection we're required to do every year, meaning that to find the rest of that inspection money, we have to take it from one of those other slices. So it's, you know, there's a lot of requirements that are sort of placed on the money. There isn't any special set aside to use to get the job done. We take it from dollars we would otherwise use on pavement. So the three slices on the left are subdivision by population. The purple slice is for places that are under 5,000 population. The green slice is for places that are above 5,000 but under 200,000. And the red slice is for places that are over 200,000. Of course, that would be only Anchorage. That group in the middle, the green group, are known as urban clusters in the language of the bill. Urban clusters are areas between 5,000 and 200,000. Now, you would think that they would follow boundaries that look logical, that are typically focused on a community, but they don't. They focus on their urban boundaries, which are very, you'd almost say they're gerrymandered just to look at them. They're very, very complex shapes, and I'll show you that in a minute here. This is the urban cluster for the Lakes, Kinnick, Fairview, and Wasilla area. You see that area in yellow. It actually encompasses Palmer, but they didn't even include Palmer in the name of this urban cluster. But to give you an idea of the complexity here, there are roads on this, see if I can show you here, you know, roads that are rather high. I believe this is Trunk Road right here. It's a project we just did here not too long ago. Trunk Road would not be eligible for that middle category. Trunk Road would be competing for all the communities under 5,000, so all the villages, many other smaller communities around the state. And we have to be mindful as we program money to projects which category a road project can fall into. And so you can see here, it makes life a little bit difficult. There are seven other urban clusters like this around the state. Another category that they funded used to be known as transportation enhancements. That was for money spent on beautification, in some cases transportation history interpretation, and primarily this money was being spent for pathways and bike trails, that sort of thing. They've now included three other categories with enhancements. They've added scenic byways, they've added safe routes to school, and they've added a program known as recreational trails. But they reduced the amount of funding overall, so these programs are now competing for a rather small amount of funding, and they place a set of rules on it that almost make the funding impossible to use. And I'll just give you one example. Neither the state nor the MPOs, Fairbanks nor Anchorage, are eligible to use the money directly. So the people that have the expertise to use federal money and follow federal rules can't participate in a project. It's really rather difficult to understand why you would do that, but that is how it's set up. MAP 21 eliminated money going to, that was a specific set aside to marine highways, but of course they did give us a different category of marine highway system funding. So we lost on one hand, but we gained on the other. There was also a separate category that was split between two states, Alaska and Hawaii, and that particular category was removed. Net, we get about the same amount of money, but it's now in a new category called ferry boat discretionary. Perhaps more painful were the cuts to the Shacklock program. This is money that was going to Canada every year, about $30 million. This is what maintains the roadways that link our two parts of Alaska, southeast, with the main body of Alaska. It was also money that we periodically were able to use on the rest of our highway system, including the ferries. So that the language there was struck entirely from Title 23. It no longer exists, so there's no possibility of that money coming back unless there is that language is reinserted.
Can we ask that when it gets done?
Yes.
Okay, we'll do that. We'll come right back to that.
Okay, another elimination. There was a program that had gone on for many decades called the Forest Highway Program. This was about $9 million annually. It had to build on highways that either led to or were within a national forest. Been a very, very beneficial program in areas such as in the Tongass and Chugach National Forests. It got replaced by a new program. The nickname is FLAP, Federal Land Access Program. FLAP program is a little bit less money, about $7 million, and it's now eligible for all classes of federal land, not just the national forest. Performance mandate. This is a big change in the bill in MAP 21. They have required that each state participate in a series of performance measures specifically targeted to the national highway system routes. So these performance measures don't apply to our entire network of roads, just to those national highway system routes. The performance measures will be targeted to safety, pavement and bridge condition, which I think are the three big ones there, and then freight mobility, congestion, and overall system performance. If those national highway system conditions fall behind, we will have to divert even more money to addressing those issues, and if we continue to get essentially a bad report card, we will be penalized with a higher match ratio that we have to give. So we'll still get the same amount of federal money, but we'll have to put more state funds to match it. So it could rise to as much as 35% in the worst case, which would be a very large increase to our current 10% that we are currently matching. This is just an example of some of the performance measures. I believe these are the ones that will be the most prominent as we go forward. Our safety numbers right now are reasonably good. We think we'll be able to meet these numbers pretty well. Our pavement condition, I can't make that statement. I think in some measures we already know that we're near the bottom of the 50 states. We're fighting some things that no other state fights. We have permafrost. We also have a lot of highways that are classed as interstate for funding reasons, but they don't have on-ramps with long distances to get the rocks and rock chips out of your tire before you hit into the mainline pavement. You're coming off a gravel road or a gravel driveway or a gravel turnout, and you're dragging that gravel right onto the road. And the way we measure pavement condition, that gravel can serve as a, it basically makes our numbers worse. So I talked about streamlining. They tried to simplify the NEPA laws that apply to the states and the highway program. Basically, Congress has been trying to streamline NEPA for several turns of the wheel, several cycles of reauthorization. But it seems like the bureaucracy back in Washington, D.C. finds a way to thwart their intent. So it's clear that the language, as you and I would read it, is pretty clear. Streamlining should be the law of the land, but we just got the regulations here about a month ago, and we don't see streamlining in the actual regulations. So it's kind of a sad story that seems to be never-ending. They also reduced the number of funding categories, though they then came back and retained the subcategories based upon population. So again, it's sort of a promise that never is quite delivered. Some other things I want was the congestion mitigation and air quality money. This is money that is designed to address the air quality issues a state may have. It grew a little bit. This may be a good thing. We have a serious air quality problem in Fairbanks known as PM or particulate matter 2.5. The area up there is having a hard time getting the measurements down that would meet federal law. And I was kind of shocked to learn that we've had three incidents in Anchorage just this past year where the air quality there has also exceeded the numbers we have to meet. Apparently the reason is the very dry winter has led to more dust on the road, and that dust has actually tripped the measurement meters. And we've had three bad days. We're only allowed one more in a three-year period. So or we face sanctions. So something to be aware of. Already, both the municipality of Anchorage and state DOT are starting to do things to do sweeping and to do some spraying with calcium chloride to try to knock down the dust. So the conclusion of MAP 21 is that it's a funding program that remains consistent with our safety lieu average. There's fewer categories but more restrictive, particularly with the reduced surface transportation program funding. There's now no dedicated bridge program. So if we're going to build and replace bridges, we need to do it with those categories known as the National Highway System and the Surface Transportation Program. Safety funding was significantly increased. This actually is one of the bigger benefits that you'll start to see here almost immediately. For example, on the Parks Highway this summer, we'll be building 13 pairs of passing lanes on that highway. So I think that is one positive takeaway from MAP 21. Just to give you the numbers, we used to get $17 million in safety. Those typically were being focused on small kind of hot spot type projects. They tripled that funding to about $50 million. And we realized that you couldn't spend that much money in a year doing $500,000 and $1 million projects, you know, the hot spot projects. You've had to find more significant and higher dollar projects, because quite frankly, a small project and a big project have all the same steps. They require all the same staff attention to right away environmental, public participation, etc. So that's why we're now focusing on we're focusing on passing lane projects going forward in all corners of the state. And I think the final thing to know is this performance measures. You know, you can't measure performance without tracking data and collecting data, and the data costs are going to go up significantly. We've already seen that happen. Our bridge inspection program, they have a new wave of, they require us to inspect bridges. What we used to do for statewide for about $8 million is now costing us about $16 million. So let me move to the next one here.
We have questions.
This might be a good place to start.
Yeah. We'll stop now, and let's go back to Shacklack because Senator Dyson had a question on that page.
I assume some discussions are happening with our Canadian neighbors on this, and they're very concerned for all the right reasons. What do you expect will happen?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, we had a meeting with our Yukon counterparts just about a month ago, and they definitely are motivated. This is a large percentage of their overall transportation program, and they quite freely admitted it. I didn't take it as a threat. I took it as just basically their financial reality, that without that money, they will have to think hard and long about if they continue to maintain parts of the Alaska Highway. That road is used predominantly by Alaskans from their own, you know, measurements. They know from, for example, passport data at the border. They are working with lobbyist firms in Washington, D.C. The governor's Washington, D.C. staff are very aware of this issue and trying to make the pitch. Leaving that to
They're working through the Department of Commerce, Senator, and we are supporting them. I'm sorry. We are supporting their efforts in that.
May I continue?
Follow-up, Senator Dyson.
Yeah. So it's also, you can make the argument that it is an alternative supply route for some Alaskan materials. Quite a bit of Alaska material flows east to support Canadian mining efforts and so on and so forth. The whole highway is a intrinsic part of the tourist thing. People come up on the ferry or their cruise ships, drive home, you know, or come the other way, and so on. But I didn't hear you say that Canadians, Yukon Territory friends, are going after their own government to pick up some money for maintaining the road.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I didn't hear him say it either.
Yeah, all right.
One thing I can say, though, we are trying to work with them to do essentially an economic benefits analysis for what does that traffic mean for Alaska, what does it mean for Yukon. That's kind of preliminary scope of work is being considered right now.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Feige.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to slide five. There you go. obviously, we've had a period of abundance in revenues, so a lot of that has gone towards the deferred maintenance backlog. My question is, with all this money that we've spent, have we made any headway on the amount of deferred maintenance? I mean, are we knocking it down, or is it, are we simply in maintaining what we have?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, the latest numbers we have are I believe 3 years ago our backlog was $680 million for all modes, and we're down to about $450 million now. Not only is it with the state-funded program, though, we're using a lot of preventative maintenance funds from our federal programs, and it is a significant drop, and it's our goal to keep that drop going. It's very much like we have to keep our highways in good shape with deferred maintenance funding and be proactive. It's like buying a used car. Do you buy a used car, or do you keep your used car going, or do you buy a new car? And the only option we see is keeping the used facilities going, and that's real aggressive crack sealing, brushing, everything we can to keep those highways in good shape and hold them together.
Okay. Thank you.
Second question.
Follow-up, Representative Feige.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On to, let's see, the couple slides down. I don't see, I guess, slide number eight. You're showing the drop there. You stated that you didn't expect that would actually happen.
No, I don't.
Okay.
No. Chair, Representative Feige. This federal program has come up to this kind of, you know, cliff several times before. They always seem to find a way. There's one slide here I meant to bring, and this, because of the slide deck confusion, I didn't get it in the right deck. If I had gotten it, what it would show is that the Highway Trust Fund will go to zero before the end of the federal fiscal year, roughly a month to a month and a half before. So there will be no money in the Highway Trust Fund. And as it's not to say it'll go zero and stay at zero, but what it says is that revenues are not equal to outlay. So there's more bills to pay than there is money coming in, and the FHWA will start to do one or two things. And I think what they'll do is they will start reimbursing us partially. That will start at a relatively small amount of delayed reimbursement and will grow with time, because it's just a growing deficit between the outlay and the income. And here's the thing to be mindful of, and I think this is what puts political pressure on Congress. To get out of 2014, that is to basically balance the books as they exit 2014, they have to reimburse the Highway Trust Fund with $3 billion. To get another few weeks past the election needs a second $3 billion. And so nobody wants to deal with what they're going to have to do prior to the election. That's been sort of the tradition there. To get through the end of 15 for the entire year, plus the deficit in 14, takes about $19 billion. So these are significant amounts of money in a fund that used to be completely self-sustaining by the users. So Congress has got a challenge ahead of them, and then they're going to have I mean, some states are so dependent upon this, they can't even keep their staff working. Certainly the USDOT can't. So unless they want to see that many furloughs going on across all, you know, all parts of the country, they're going to have to address this.
Doesn't bode well for 2016, does it?
No.
I guess my eventual question was, why did you expect that to go back up, as you have on the graph there?
Well, the reason is that you notice it goes back up, but it doesn't go up to the same level. Mm-hmm. So what's going to happen, I believe, is by then some of the older projects have been paid off. They no longer are asking for reimbursement from the Highway Trust Fund.
Okay.
Thank you,
Madam
Chair.
Thank you. Senator Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along that same lines, then, is the country facing a majority of the funds coming in to the Federal Highway Fund a gas tax? Is that where they're getting most of the revenue from?
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, correct.
And so
there are some other taxes, too, but fuel taxes are the big part.
And so as we're pushing towards hybrid cars and electric use, it's limiting the way that the federal government is receiving money into the fund. Is that correct?
Correct. The Highway Trust Fund is primarily funded off of the tax on petroleum fuels. So if a vehicle is being fueled with natural gas or with electricity, it's currently paying no tax at all, except maybe the tax when they purchase tires. But, you know, with today's modern tires, that's a 5 or 6 year cycle. There's a lot of talk about we need to restructure how the tax is paid. Should it be miles driven? Should it be just a flat tax on each vehicle that's registered? A lot of discussion. Individual states are experimenting, but I don't think anyone is prepared for the complete transformation of the taxing system that it would take to do something else. The other thing I would add is even if they aren't using, you know, an alternate fuel, the CAFE standards are ratcheting up, so that car makers are just simply making the liquid-fueled vehicles more efficient.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to point that out, that it's a very complex reason why we're not holding that system up anymore, and some of it has to do with pushing to alternative fuels. Some of it has to do with manufacturers, rightfully so, making a more efficient car for our highway system. Anyway, I know that we're looking at those things and whether it should be that Alaska should look differently at how we collect those types of taxes. Madam Chair, if I might, my question is actually somewhere else, and it lends itself to Fairbanks, actually.
Follow-up, Representative, or Senator Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at slide 20, and this is where we said our funding went from $17 million to now $50 million. Is that correct?
That is correct, Senator Faircloth.
I might, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
Mr. Audison, I was recently looking at volcanic eruptions around the world and see that there's an active volcano on the Big Island in Hawaii that's been active since the 80s. And I understand they have something going over there called VOG, V-O-G instead of fog. And I'm wondering then how they're compliant with any kind of particulate matter and how they've gotten an exemption because of a naturally occurring spew of particulate matter into the air. And the reason I ask that is because we have a naturally occurring inversion in Anchorage, Alaska, where the carbon, not carbon, but all the particulate matter can get held into the particular area, not for any reason that the city is doing anything inappropriately, but because the weather is coming in and holding all of that matter there. Same thing's happening in Fairbanks. You've got an inversion that's holding everything in the valley. So how does Hawaii, are they under, how could a Hawaii and Anchorage or Hawaii and Alaska work together with the federal government to know that, to let them know we can't control what Mother Nature is doing?
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, that's a, it's an interesting question. These kinds of natural causes to particulate matter, whether it be the dust off of agricultural fields or a volcanic eruption or a glacier, you know, winds sweeping dust back into the air like happens near Palmer and Wasilla. They do allow, EPA does allow certain natural events to be kind of excused. But I think the bottom line is in Hawaii, where the volcano is rather rural. They probably aren't actually measuring it for EPA's purposes because there aren't a lot of people living there. I've been there. I've flown over that area, and I saw a lot of subdivisions that have got, you know, 30 feet of hardened lava going right across the road system, and people aren't living there anymore. So I think it's, we probably need to join forces with a lot of other states, not just Hawaii.
Okay. Senator Bishop, you had a question.
Thank you. I'm going to be real brief because I have to run to another meeting. But an observation, and I'm sure you're all over it, Commissioner Kemp. But I was a little concerned about what's transpired in Fairbanks last week with it looks like the impending closure of Flint Hills, the ability to make asphalt, and I asked Tesoro this. Can they meet our asphalt needs here in this state this year? Is it and have you been asking those same questions? Because it's already expensive enough to build lane miles here without importing asphalt into the state. So that's one comment. Slide 12, Jeff, on your presentation. Where would FMATs fit in? Because I see FMATs is not bulleted here. Would they fit in this green category here on this pie chart? FMATs?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, the FMATs is getting a population pro rata share of that green slice.
Okay.
So if you take FMATs population and all the other seven or eight places that are like classified, they're all getting a dollar per dollar. So
okay, thank
about
you.
$8 million for FMATs.
Thank you. And
follow-up, Senator Bishop.
I apologize, Madam Chairman. Safe routes to schools. I'd like to visit with you guys offline about that. And thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Next is, first of all, I want to announce that we've had two members join our committee, Representative Isaacson and Representative Lynn. But I have a list here. Next is Senator Eagy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jeff, if you can go back to slide 3, and you talk about Shacklet, but I can't discern between the amounts. I know Shacklet, looking at the slide, it looks like Shacklet had the bulk of everything. I know they didn't, but I know there was a lot of money in Shacklet that has disappeared now.
Well,
so can you give me a...
Yeah, I can
percentage of Shacklet money that we're going to lose in the overall?
Through the chair, Senator Egan, that in the year 2012, there's a turquoise slice near the at the very top of the bar chart. The number there would be $30 million.
Okay.
That's unique from the Shacklet that goes to Canada. And I'm not showing the Canada money here because it doesn't ever touch our ledger. Never comes to the state. It's a transfer from the federal government on the U.S. side to the federal government on the Canadian side, and then the Canadian federal government transfers it to Yukon. So it never really is on our books. We're just aware of it because it's important to us. This $30 million in 2012 is a type of Shacklet that benefits Alaska. It does come into our ledger and is used by projects within Alaska.
Follow-up.
I know there's a lot of money that has been used on Klondike Highway, and that's going to increase load-wise with transportation hauling ore from the Yukon to Skagway. Now how will we get money for Klondike Highway now beyond the border?
Through the chair, Senator Egan, the Klondike Highway is a national highway system route, so it's competing for money from that national highway system category.
But how about on the other side of the border? I mean, the bulk of the Klondike Highway is in the Yukon.
The Canadian portion of the only highways eligible in Canada for the $30 million a year that they receive is the Haines Highway and from Haines Junction north to the Alaska border on the Alaska.
So there was never any shagwag money on the Klondike?
No.
Follow up.
One more question, Madam Chair. When you talk about bridges, so you're telling us that there is no bridge replacement money anymore under MAP 21. I'm sure there'll be another bill, but
through the chair, Senator Egan, there's that smaller category that's about just under $4 million.
But that involves more than bridge replacement funds, correct?
Right.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And it's, as I indicated in my testimony, it's currently not even adequate to do the inspections on those bridges.
Okay. Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is much bigger picture, and it relates to both federal and state revenues. Obviously, the feds are giving us a lot less money in the future, no matter what happens next fiscal year, but years past that, big shortfall. What do you see the future of transportation funding in Alaska being, both state and federal?
Well, through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, I'm not sure my crystal ball is much better than anyone else in the room, but I think a couple things come out. It couldn't come at a worse time for Alaska with the current deficit. That's certainly an obvious. There are many members of Congress that are just advocating to defederalize the whole program. Just stop collecting the federal tax, let states individually collect that tax and add it to their own kitties. Since we're a 5-to-1 state, meaning for every dollar collected in Alaska by the federal gas tax, we're getting $5 back. The math would be very difficult for us. We would have to do something pretty dramatic to the gas tax to make it even reach par with what we're getting now. So it's tough. We're already seeing nationwide, you're seeing people widely talk about tolls. Tolls are now being used all over the country. Even Alaska's got a toll proposal going on the Kinnickahn Bridge. Are we ready for that? I don't know. You guys are the policymakers. You're better touch with it. But it's tough. There's no doubt about it.
Follow-up, Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. And I appreciated Senator Fairclough's question earlier regarding why revenues are diminishing in the trust fund. And my understanding is it's what changed. We've got hybrid cars, electric cars, but also miles driven by Americans are simply decreasing as we become a more urbanized society. And finally, the federal fuel taxes haven't been adjusted for inflation, I think, since 1993, so the purchasing power is diminishing every year. My question is, with state fuel taxes, when was the last time they were adjusted for inflation? And I appreciate that they're not dedicated funds, they don't go just to transportation, but nonetheless, I'm curious.
Through the chair, Representative Christ Tompkins, there were a couple back and forths in the 60s, and they settled on about 8 cents a gallon, and that number, other than the 1 year where we suspended the gas tax under Governor Palin, it's stayed the same in 8 cents. I think what's interesting about that level is in the 60s, when it was set, Alaska had the highest fuel tax in the entire nation. It's currently the lowest.
53 years, I think, that it hasn't changed. So, Representative Isaacson, you have the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I have several, and many of them have actually been addressed, so I appreciate that. But just if I could clarify a couple, going with this immediate line of questions about revenue forecasts, if we have not changed our gas tax for 53 years at 8 cents, and as you see declining revenue streams and growing demands, what's your recommendation to us as policymakers? And I apologize because I was gone earlier, and then sometimes in sub-finance committee for DOT, I'm gone as well. I have to split. So if you've covered this before, I apologize. But what are the projections that you see we need to help you cover, and what recommendations for revenue do you have?
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, you know, I feel that I'm not at liberty to make just exactly the statements that, you know, might want to be said. This is a tough situation. Some people don't realize it's as dire as it may appear. If Congress comes along and finds a way to fill that hole in the bottom of the Highway Trust Fund, we can proceed for maybe another decade. But you guys can read the tea leaves of Washington, D.C. You know, there's one side that says no new revenue, another side says no new borrowing. The third choice would be let's just cut the program. Let's reduce the amount of outlay to match the inflow. I think those are the choices facing Congress. And if they pick the last one, which might be the easiest, because it does keep the program going, it does keep, you know, some fraction of the total employment employed. There we are. We'll have a lesser program. We'll have to make hard choices. I'll give you an example of what other states are doing. State of North Carolina, state of Texas are both converting paved roads to gravel roads by the tens of thousands of miles.
Oh, my goodness.
Madam Chair, clarification.
Well, I know, I just want to make one comment here. I know in North Carolina, they have so many roads that when I lived there, there was a paved road within 10 miles of every community college, and there were 53 community colleges. So go ahead and follow up, Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to clarify, when you say that they're going from paved roads to gravel, when we had the challenge in North Pole of trying with $50,000 to tackle maybe a $6 million project on part of PERIDOT, we opted to also do the same. Instead of doing what we had done before with pavement, we did with gravel, but it was a chip seal. And chip seal has come a long way. Can you explain whether or not that should be a policy consideration, or is there a drawback because of other maintenance concerns and an intended consequence of trying to save a buck?
Representative Isaacson, through Chair. Yes, we are looking at chip seals, and we're looking at aggressively pursuing those on the Kenai Peninsula. We did two projects there last year, and I hope to continue that program. It's something new in our central region. But I would also like to add on, you know, we're not sitting on our thumbs with this issue. We're taking a look at the projects we have in the mill, in the STIP, and we're looking at rescoping some of these projects. And we have to get back to our core mission. And when I talk like this, when it's very similar to what happened with the Alaska Class Ferry. We went out with a $30 million vessel. It grew to $150 or $175 million vessel. It was scope creep. The same thing happens with our highways. We go out with an intent to repair a pavement. I'll just give you an analogy, and we go into the communities. We get input, and they'll say things like, "Oh, we'd like a bike path," and we will go, "Oh, bike path's pretty good. We want lights. Oh, well, let's light it. We want this. We want that." Well, when you widen a facility, a roadway, the costs go up exponentially. And we're going to take a hard look at these projects we have in our program, and we're going to look at dialing some of these projects back, and we're going to try and go longer and skinnier. and this isn't a new concept. This is what states usually have to do. I know communities like the amenities. I like the paths. I like the lights. But the fact of the matter is, we have to take a hard look at all our projects and run them through the mill again and see what's best for Alaskans, for both the safety aspect and for drivability. So we are going through that now. We're not just going to sit back and on our heels, like I say. We're going to really get into our projects. I believe we had 135 projects in our what we call our NHPP program. That's the NHS. That's the major roads, and we're going to take a look at those and see about what we're doing with scope. Some you can't get away from the urban projects. It's pretty tough not to put sidewalks in an urban area, but we're going to be aggressive with this, and we're going to attack it head on, and we'll take care of Alaska's transportation system. That said, as I mentioned before, we're going to have to take care of what we have too. We have to keep putting or using deferred maintenance funds to keep our highways intact. We just can't let the Alaska Highway or Tok cut off or one of these rural NHS highways get away from us, or that it'll cost very, very much more funds in the future.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Follow up, Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. And Commissioner, I know that you are very intentional when you say that you're wanting to get back to the core mission, and I appreciate that. But when we're looking at having to make the policy decisions, and I appreciate Jeff being able to say, here's what some other states have done, because we need to be exposed to that, because we're not living and breathing this all the time as you're able to do, because it is your core mission. But as we're talking about the costs, before we add more tax and so forth, we need to look at the structural and programmatic ways that we're going about this. For example, sitting on FMATs, it always amazed me how much it cost just to upgrade the roads. You said adding a light, for example. To me, you know, playing SimCity or something, you want a light, you design a light, and you stick it all up. You know, we all played that as kids, or, perhaps. I did, I don't know. But it's not that easy in real life. Each light that we wanted to move on South Cushman would cost us $100,000. You can't just duplicate. Now, so it leads me to ask, if the city could do things for a lot less than DOT, has the state burdened DOT? Have we as legislators burdened you with having to account for so many complexities and expenses that we've driven up the cost of being able to allow you to design a road affordably? Is there stuff that you could recommend that says, look, here's our the focus of our mission is to provide safe transportation corridors from point A to point B, but you've tasked us to also make sure of this, that, and the other thing, or you've tasked us to leverage our dollars with federal money, and this comes with these exact burdens. So could you help us define what we should strip away if it has to come down to a point where, you know, we need to tear in and say we need more money, or maybe we just need to tear out the services, and rather than make you do more with less money, maybe have you do more with less requirements. Do you know what I'm saying? And help us identify the onerous requirements that go into planning and engineering a road that aren't necessary. It's necessary in a community. I know in North Pole, we need our sidewalks. We have people who are walking against traffic or with traffic on very skinny roads with a lot of traffic because we've taken away access to the Richardson Highway. And so they're off on St. Nicholas, and that's been addressed, and I appreciate that. But we have that in other areas too. Black Road, that's being addressed. I appreciate that. But it's just an expensive prospect. So many roads, and the design is so expensive. It seems like we can help you, but we need to know where to help you that is going to be instructive and not destructive to your mission.
And I want to add to that, while you're doing that, tell us whether those rules and regulations are state or federal. So is there, I mean, some of them we can't do anything about, but which ones can we?
Certainly. Representative Isaacson, certainly. My department right now is looking at, in fact, we're kicking it off this week, of a huge efficiency effort. We're bringing in our leaders into Juneau, and we're going to discuss that very thing on efficiencies. I would venture to guess that, not guess, but say that the majority of our projects within a community, which requires community approval through, I can't remember the title, 3530. The scope of those projects usually grows with the community. And you can't blame the community. The amenities are nice. But given this downturn, it makes it a little bit more difficult for us, and where do we put our effort? And our effort, as far as we can see, and we're going through the analysis, is to go back to our core. Yes, there is a lot of federal bureaucracy. There's some state bureaucracy, the historical process. Everyone has heard of 106, the 4F process. We could go on and on with those, but I think the bigger picture is I'm planning on keeping this department operating within its means, the funding we have now, and finding out a better way to do business. And I think we can get there, and I'll certainly know more in a few months. And the STIP exercise we're going to go through is going to be important, not only NHS side of the STIP, but the STP side of the STIP. This is where it will really affect communities. And there's a lot of expectations out there that we build a lot of projects, and we just cannot do it. It's a fiscal reality. Okay. I've been saying this for about a year, I believe. I started in here.
Okay, thank you very much. And we're going to go on. Senator Egan, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a comment before I ask the question. We have had very good results here in the city and borough of Juneau and other low-volume roads and streets in southeast Alaska with BST, with bituminous surface treatment, sort of like chip seal.
Yep.
And for low-volume roads, I know it works very well. And the neat thing about it, they're easy to maintain. If you get a hole, you know, you can get out there with a truck and fix it a heck of a lot easier than getting a big paving machine and tearing it up and redoing it. So,
Senator Egan, through the chair, I'll give you an instance of what we're going through right now. About 15 years ago, we created a gravel to black program where we paved just about everything, even over bad bases. You should never pave over a bad base. When the pavement falls apart and it cracks and deforms, it's much more costly to fix that. That's what we're going through right now. We have some pavement cracks that it's just on low volume roads where it's more cost effective to grind the pavement up and put a chip over it, and getting over that hurdle is tough. We're finding that some in the Kenai populace did not like what we did on I can't remember the Kenai, but I think that those are kind of things that makes perfect sense. The Canadians are experts at high float chips, and Southeast has an aggressive program. The Northern region has an aggressive program, and I think that's one of the cost savings measures we're seeing in the Central region.
Follow up,
sorry, Madam Chair. Just one question. You were talking about the funding difference for Alaska Marine Highway System. So are we going to lose funding for NHS, or
through the,
or is it going to be ranked differently?
Chair, Senator Egan, the ferries and the terminals are eligible for either the NHPP funding, which is targeted on the NHS, or for the STP funding. The distinction being, if the terminal is attached to an NHS highway, as it is here in Juneau, as it is in many of the larger communities of Southeast, also Kodiak, Whittier, Valdez, then the vessels that call upon that terminal and the terminal itself are eligible for NHPP funding. So that funding source has to address that set of needs as well. The smaller communities which don't have NHS highways within them, the ferries and terminals are eligible for STP funding. So some part of those slices on the pie that I showed you will have to be allocated to the ferry system on an annual basis just to keep up with the wear and tear. And we see it all the time. We're probably doing 3 or 4 or 5 ferry terminals every year in our spending plan.
So we're still, I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
So we want to get onto the step.
I know
because,
that.
You know, so.
But we're still on the National Highway System. We're still on NHS, and that funding formula hasn't changed?
Through the Chair, Senator Egan, the NHPP funding went up in amount. So, you know, most of the ferries are eligible for NH funding. It's only the smaller ferries. And the way the ferry system operates, almost all of our vessels touch an NHS terminal sometime in their mm-hmm. in their year. So if you got a vessel that's, you know, transiting to Angoon and Hoonah and Gustavus, but it comes back to Juneau, you know, a couple times a week, it's eligible for NHPP funding.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, and this is going to be our last one before we start our STIP process, and that's Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, on following up on Representative Isaacson's line of questioning as far as how do we deliver a better project and how do we prioritize those projects. As we move forward in letting the people of Alaska know the actual costs associated with what's available for an improvement and then trying to prevent scope creep, I hope we allow an individual community the opportunity to tax themselves and work as partners if they want those amenities, if they're a high enough priority for those communities to want to pay for a sidewalk or to pay for an asphalt trail, a more park and rec trail, that they be provided that opportunity for those considerations. But understanding the state only has X amount of money, and that if you delay a project, which some may want to try to do, that we find a way that that doesn't happen. If somebody's just throwing on amenities to actually stop a project, that doesn't work either. But if there's a fund set up locally so that they can have money brought to bear on particular project improvements. But back on slide 18, again, I don't need an answer today, though a comment would be appreciated. Under pavement conditions, we talked about we've currently classified some of Alaska state roads as interstates. Because then they'll qualify for reimbursement from the federal government. And I'm wondering if there's a cost-benefit analysis to that classification. And what I mean in a nutshell is, have we classified ourselves out of making the repair and maintenance on those the state's responsibility where it should be in trying to access the federal funds and then just creating continuous maintenance problems on the road? So is there a way... Is there a way financially, if you looked at the picture, if they were pulled off of that, whether we saw benefit by doing it ourselves versus it seems like we have enough in the federal line looking for funds that if we diverted those roads, then we could actually change the standards on those roads to do exactly what you're saying. So I didn't know if there was an analysis financially being run on that particular model to see if we've sort of priced ourselves by road conditions based on a label that may or may not apply today.
Through the Chair, Senator Fairclough, the category funding that we became eligible for by getting that classification added was interstate maintenance, because all other states that had interstates were receiving some fraction of a category known as interstate maintenance. So this made us eligible. It was really rather remarkable. It brought several tens of millions of dollars a year. But the roads in question are already National Highway System routes and are some of the most important routes in the state, the Parks Highway, the Seward Highway. I don't think you'd want to go backward in that sense. You'd be now making those highways compete for that STP category, which is even more constrained.
Thank you.
So.
Okay, thank you. And let's now go through the STIP and I'm sure we'll have lots of questions after that. But so please mark your page number that you want to go back to or the subject matter.
So we have full screen down here. So This is a kind of a discussion of the STIP with a lot of attention given to the scoring system that we use in the STIP and how we came to have that scoring system. I think you're going to learn something here. I don't think many people, even people in the department, know the genesis of the scoring system. Basically, in 1991, Congress, in the then authorization, added language in the section called 23 U.S.C. 118D. And basically what that meant was we had a whole class of new roads that had become eligible for STIP funds, but the traditional methods of identifying projects didn't work for them. Prior to that, there were two ways projects found their way on the STIP. They either were in a state-adopted transportation plan, or they were identified in what we called management systems. And at the time, the three management systems were safety, pavement condition, and bridge condition. Very similar to the performance measures we're talking about now. It's just that they didn't have penalties and national standards we had to meet. When 118 passed, we came to have, as I go through this, let me back up and say, just go through the slides in proper order. The Federal Aid Highway Program is an extremely complex, repeatedly amended 60-year-old program. When they passed Safety in Lieu in 2005, there were 1,700 pages of law. It's kind of a big thing to keep up with. It takes a while to develop expertise. A lot of those laws have created the things that we repeatedly are talking to you about, the long-range plan, the STIP, these categories of funding. The STIP rules came to be known in 1991, required that all surface transportation projects, and by surface transportation I mean highways, trails, buses, ferries, ferry terminals, all things that are eligible for surface transportation funding. They had to be shown in this document called the STIP, which is essentially a listing of projects by year of spending with a description and a location. It had to be financially constrained, meaning we had to adjust the amount of project work and its cost to match the amount of dollars we anticipated. Had to have a four-year horizon. We can update it more frequently, but that was the duration the STIP had to cover. It also has to contain all the subordinate TIPs, as they're called, which are transportation improvement programs, one for FMATS, one for AMATS, one for the tribal transportation program, one for the forest highway program, which is now defunct, but for many, many years it had to be there. So it really was kind of the mother of all the statewide projects, and also it was carrying kind of the chicks, if you would, all these smaller TIPs that are coming from around the state. We also have to certify, the commissioner has to sign a letter whenever we amend or update the STIP, that a whole laundry list of rules are being followed. So he's signing that, you know, we have followed everything from civil rights laws to all the laws that are unique to the STIP. Our federal partners, FHWA and FTA, both must approve each STIP and each amendment. So there is federal oversight as we go forward. Some other requirements, and this is one that's probably little known. The STIP and the project in it must be consistent with the statewide transportation plan. This is not a little threat. It has been litigated in Alaska at least two times that I know of. In one case, we were successful. It went to the Ninth Circuit. We had it in our long-range plan, and the Ninth Circuit agreed with us. In another case, it went to state court, and we did not prevail because that project was not in our long-range plan, and it took us about a year and a half to update the plan and make that project eligible. There's an extensive public process. There is now, you're going to find this kind of laughable, but there are now four different C's that we must adopt or follow. They are coordination, consultation, just that's two of the four. There's two more like that, and they literally, those words have definitions. And depending upon who you are, we have to follow one of the C rules. You know, some organizations get a higher classification than others. All transit highway projects are included in the STIP. Even projects like go to the Alaska Railroad Corporation directly, they have to be in our STIP. we have to be meeting air quality standards. This is a big deal for us because if we start getting non-attainment days, as are happening in both Fairbanks and in Anchorage, the penalties become, they stair step up. They start rather low, but they can become very severe. At their most severe stage, EPA takes over riding the STIP. They become our masters. It's happened in other states. It's happened in California. It's happened in Georgia. So it's not without precedent. And like I said, we've had three outbreaks of dust just in the past few months in Anchorage, and we're having many more than that of dust in Fairbanks. And the Fairbanks one's particularly perplexing because the dust problem is not transportation related. It's mostly the burning of fuels, primarily wood. So not much we can do in the transportation program to solve the problem in Fairbanks, but yet we will be the ones being penalized. When I say we, I mean the state's transportation program. As we went forward in time with these STIP rules, we created four categories. They have been codified in regulation. One is the National Highway System. One is the Community Transportation Program, which is essentially kind of community class roads. And those can be roads that are owned by the state, Glacier Highway being an example, Mendenhall Loop. It's just that the purpose of that road is primarily local traffic. The third major category is the Alaska Highway System. There's 1,500 miles of highway in the state that belong to the this category. There are then, and the final one was TRAC, which is essentially that enhancement program, trails, beautification, historic type projects. We're required to sub-allocate some of our funding to our two MPOs, FMATS and AMATS. In the past, there was not a specific formula and law that applied to Alaska, and now under MAP 21, there is a specific formula, and both those organizations get money by that formula. The eligibility, all public roads, ferries, and buses. This came about because of that 118E that I talked about. This was the law that kind of changed Alaska's world. And the law applies to only two jurisdictions. It applies to Puerto Rico and Alaska. So it's a unique Alaska law. If you notice here, on the second bullet, there's four STIP categories, as I just enumerated. The first two in black are primarily state-owned highways, and they're to get 48% and 8%. This is now set in regulation. The community transportation program is to get 39%, 2% to the track program, and then we give ourselves a little bit of flexibility because sometimes it's hard to hit targets. You know, you're trying to program to a precise dollar amount, but at the same time, your projects are cost what they cost. So we've got the ability to move a little bit against those targets. We established scoring in 1994. It's now one of three ways that a project gets into the STIP. One is our plans that we identify projects like the Southeast Plan and the Southwest Plan. That's one method. And this method is required by both state and federal law. I cite the two laws there. They both say essentially the same thing. First do a plan, then identify projects off of that plan. So that's been around since before 118. The second one was by these management systems where our bridge conditions, our pavement conditions, and our safety circumstances are being evaluated, and we pick projects based upon the data those systems contain. We realized that when 118 passed, we did not have the ability to these locally owned roads weren't in state plans, and they weren't in state management systems. So how were we going to give them a fair shake and get access to the STIP if they weren't in the two primary methods? And we came up with scoring as a way to respond to 23118E. That should be D, excuse me. That law has bounced around as they add and subtract sections in the law over the last few years. And I sometimes forget, is it D or is it E? But it is D. This is what 118D says. Funds made available to the state of Alaska and the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico may be expended for construction of access and development roads that will serve resource development, recreational, residential, commercial, industrial, or other like purposes. Pretty broad definition. any public road in Alaska, unlike the other 49 states. Now, what they did is they grew our eligibility from 30% of public roads to 100%. They didn't grow the amount of money. We almost tripled the amount of roads that were eligible, but now they're competing for the same bucket of funds. This chart here is busy, but I think if I take a minute to help you understand it, I think you'll find it really does explain the nut of the problem. There's four tiers shown here, labeled arterial, urban and major collector, minor collector, and local roads. These are functional classifications. They're ways of defining a road's purpose. An arterial's primary purpose is to move traffic at higher speeds, long distances. Egan Drive in Juneau, Parks Highway, or Tudor Road in Anchorage. You could go on. There's, as you go down that tier, the collectors are less busy roads. They're starting to serve two purposes. They're not only serving the through traffic purpose, they're also serving local access. By the time you get to local roads, their primary purpose is local access. They're to access properties, and they connect to the other tiers eventually. You can see the bottom two tiers are 70% of the road miles. Those two categories are not eligible for federal funds in 49 states. Only in Alaska and Puerto Rico are these two lower tiers eligible for the Federal Highway Program funds. The coloring you see on the chart, the green are DOT-owned roads, and the area that represented by the color is the percentage of roads in that category. So if you look at arterials, you know, almost 99% of the roads are owned by DOT. As you move down to local roads, the vast majority are owned by local government primarily. So there's a clear progression, but what happened in 1991 is every road on that in that triangle became eligible. If you look over on the left, you see the vehicle miles of travel and the number of accidents are clearly skewed toward arterials, where those same factors are skewed in the other direction toward local roads and minor collectors. So clearly, we've added a lot of road miles, but all the action, what I like to say is this is where the economy happens, is on the upper two tiers. This is where freight moves. This is how people get to work. This is clearly where the state's economy is occurring. But because of that change in law, we had to find a way to let all these roads become eligible for funding and give them a fair shake at access to the dollars. So eligible roads, because of that law change, grew from 30 to 100%. No additional money. Most of the roads that were added were not found in planning documents, and nor would it be the state's responsibility to plan. Local governments do their own planning, particularly for roads that they own and maintain. They were not in our management systems, other than bridges. So we felt we had to have a new mechanism for projects that would have otherwise never achieved funding, and hence came scoring. So we created a system where anyone can nominate a project, local government, tribes, businesses, legislators, state agencies have all in the past nominated projects. We all, at the same time, we recognize there's no way we're going to do every road. You just cannot do it. So we created, you know, priorities. And in rural Alaska, the priorities beginning in the 90s was the sanitation road needs. As the state was beginning to build landfills, sewage lagoons, water points, things like that, also airports, docking facilities. Those are the kind of projects that were given priority. And I'm happy to say that we've done most of those needs across the state. We have served those villages with projects that are in this in sweet spot, so to speak. We also had to find a way to say some roads are just not important enough to share these limited dollars. So we have identified categories, for example, paving local roads in small communities with a few number of cars was not a sweet spot. It was not going to get priority. There just wasn't enough cars. There isn't enough speed to justify paving those kind of roads. Ultimately, though, there's hard choices. You have to have hard choices, and you have to be able to make them, because otherwise there's just not enough funding. This also explains why the National Highway System and the Alaska Highway System, which are higher level roads, that are primarily owned by the state and are also covered by our management systems were never considered for scoring. We already had good information about the needs on those systems. We already knew where traffic was growing, where accidents were occurring, where pavement and bridge condition were failing. It didn't make sense to already have good data about where you need to do projects to create an artificial scoring system on top of that, information that already exists. The other exception to scoring is that the two MPOs, FMETS and AMETS, they, by federal law, are given a share of the money. They're given responsibility for doing their own planning, and they're given responsibility for doing their own project selection. So they, too, have, although both those organizations have their own scoring system, they don't follow the state scoring system. So we have, as John Bender said earlier today, different kinds of work, you need different scoring. It's almost impossible to have a single set of criteria that cover all the different things. It'd be very hard to compare a ferry to a highway. It's hard to compare a highway to a transit need. And in Alaska, with such divergence in our population and our busyness of our communities, you know, in communities that have primarily four-wheelers, it would never be fair to compare them with the growing urban needs of Mat-Su or Anchorage. So we ended up with scoring systems for both rural roads and urban communities. We have a scoring system for transit. We have another one listed here, but another one for ferries. We had a category called intelligent transportation systems, and finally the enhancements. We had different criteria. To make the scoring fair, we normalized the maximum score each category can achieve. And we've actually done a lot of retroactive analysis to make sure, well, not all the money is going to one category, but not others. We've tried to see if a well-scored project that had that hit the criteria well could achieve a high enough score to be funded. And we've done a pretty good job of normalizing the scoring criteria and the weights to make that outcome. We have a nomination cycle that occurs every 2 years, but I will be honest. Because of the MAP 21 funding decline, we have skipped scoring now for 2 years. We are now going into the fourth year with no new scoring because we have such a backlog of projects, some of which are already begun, but it will take many years to get to the point to where there's money for them, and others which have been scored and have a score, but we don't have money to start the design work. So there's no sense giving people false hope, bring your project, this gets scored, and put you at the bottom of the queue. So we score things twice. Once is to get it into the needs list and identify should it go forward to be scored statewide. And the second scoring is then by a statewide panel that's very similar to the one at the APEB. I think it has 5 of 6 identical members. So I think the difference is on the highway side, we use the chief engineer rather than the chief of maintenance. That's the big difference. So one of the things we've learned is scoring is a tedious cycle. It can take 30 to 45 minutes to score a single project. We typically schedule scoring for 2 to 3 days, and that's about the maximum a person can sit there and listen to the criteria and data and stay focused. And what we find is that when we score for 2 days, we've identified enough work that we probably have 6 years worth of potential projects in terms of funding. This is we've already talked about the definition of formula funds. We did that in MAP 21 on the categories. And the formula funds do have an eligibility of purpose. They have longevity. They have some funds do or do not have transferability. And some have sub-allocations that we have to be mindful of. So picking projects against the funding and the eligibility and all these other factors is a process that literally takes years to train staff to do this well. It's not something you just pick up very quickly. And I'm sorry to tell you that one of my most senior staff who knows this extremely well has just recently announced his resignation. So we've lost an expert going to the feds. Mike Figue. The other thing to know about the STIP, and this can add to confusion, is there's always two STIPs that are out there. There's the one we're working under, the one that is guiding the projects that we're funding, and it often is being amended as well. And then there's another one that is being prepared to replace that previous STIP, because we're trying to activate a new STIP every 2 years, so that we basically can true it. We identify the projects that have been accomplished. We identify the projects that have had their most updated cost estimate, because we have to do a STIP that is financially constrained that impacts the whole rest of the eligible pool. We currently are working under 2011 to 2014. We're working on Amendment 9. And that sounds like a lot of amendments until you understand that in some states the STIP is amended twice a week. Yeah. We're actually better than most states in this regard. We at the same time are working on 2014 to 2017, and we really are dealing with this issue of how many projects, what is the scope of those projects, what can we do to get as many projects accomplished that serve basic transportation needs and live within the money we have, because we this is clearly one of the messages we're facing. We can no longer just let the scope of projects run wild, or we will obviously do less and less for an awful lot of people. Well, that's all I have, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Jeff. I really appreciate that. I have a question. In the process of all this, whenever it happened, as far as state projects go, the only ones that we really have any control over, do we need to change anything? Do we need to change the criteria? Do we need to, some of that you're going to automatically do yourselves, but is there anything that we need to change in our statutes that that we just need to think about?
Madam Chair, let me give you one example that I notice. We've had two recent bond issues in 2008 and 2012. There's a typical practice, I think I'm being fair in saying this, in that to get as many projects onto the bond list as possible, we don't necessarily have good estimates that are tied back to the scope of work that's expected. Said differently, we have size 14 shoes trying to fit into a ballerina shoe budget. It's just, you can't do them all. And so in the past, in 2002 bond issue, and even in 2008, we would almost automatically federalize those projects that had inadequate budgets. Why did we do that? So that we could deliver those projects and have enough money to deliver them. We're gonna have a hard time to do that right now with 2012, and that makes hard choices. The bonding process allows us to move money from one project, cannibalize it if you would, to accomplish another project. But that's going to leave a project undone. So I think we need to think about that. If we're automatically creating an expectation of a list of projects that can't be achieved because they simply cost more than the scope of work, what do we do about that? What is the solution to that? Do we come back and ask for more money? But you saw those numbers on the state capital budget. They go up and down like this, depending upon the price of oil, in the London Brent exchange. I don't know what that solution is. I know it's hard. We also, at the same time, need a little bit of flexibility. And I'll just give you one real-life example. We had two projects in 2008 bond issue. They were both funded by about half. In other words, we needed another equal amount of money in each project to make them fully buildable. One of them was a bridge. You can't build half a bridge. It's very hard to scope down a bridge. And the other was just, 15 miles of repavement and a bike trail and a new bridge as well. So we federalized both of them. As time went on and we're getting ready to go to construction, one of the projects had 125 encroachments, which is a federal law that we have to meet. So if we have encroachments in the right-of-way, even if it's not needed for construction, we still have to clear the right-of-way of those encroachments. Business signs, I think the worst one in terms of the difficulty of getting the encroachment cleared was the rectory for a Catholic church. We would just not rather try to take out 125 encroachments. It can be very, very complicated, and communities get upset and they write to their legislators and all the things that happen. So we thought to ourselves and said, we could take all the GO bond money on the encroachment project and move it over to the bridge project, and it would have enough. and we could take all the federal money from the bridge project, other way around. We're moving all the bond money to the encroachment project. Then we don't have to do the encroachments. It's now federally funded. And the bridge project didn't have any federal impediments. Both projects went out to bid last summer. We achieved it, but we did it by, probably doing things that some people would question. But I believe that two projects completed is better than one project completed.
Absolutely. Is there any thought, and I know municipalities will cringe at this, but we've with some of our state-funded harbors, we've tried to fix up the harbor and give it to the community and say, now you're going to have to maintain it.
Right.
I mean, we're going to have to look at doing some things like that. And the municipalities, I mean, they're having a hard time too, so I'm not even suggesting that I want to do this, because I don't. But we have to look at every single scenario and at what the possibilities are, what the ramifications are, and I would never think to do that if we're thinking of ever fooling around with revenue sharing, So there's a lot of things that hinge on different things. But has that ever been talked about in any way? I have no idea.
Madam Chair, if you just look at our three modes that the state funds fairly routinely, highways, aviation, and harbors. In harbors, we expect 50% sharing, cost sharing. And that's just, it's in statute. You can't change it. In aviation, most of the airports are owned by the state, and the state pays the match. But if an airport is owned by a local government, like in Juneau and Kenai and Merrill Field, we pay half of their match. I don't know if that's in statute or that's just in practice. And if you look at highways, we pay, except for the lowest class of roads, we pay almost all the match as well. When you require a community to pay at least something, it helps tamp down that scope creep because they got to pay more too. I think that's one sort of self-healing solution when communities don't have a check being written by somebody else, no matter what they ask for. And that's how our highway program is currently working. You could say the same thing about our utility policy. We pay far more for utility relocation than other states do. I believe that's an artifact of early statehood days when utilities were owned by local government. They didn't have a lot of funding, and so the state was trying to be fair to them. But utilities now are multi-billion-dollar corporations, and yet we're subsidizing them at times.
Are there any other questions? Senator Egan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I have five questions, but I'll just ask two. And the slide's not numbered, but STIP Basics 4. What roads are involved in the Alaska highway system? You listed 8%. What qualifies for that?
Through the chair, Senator Egan, the list is identified and in regulation.
One more.
Which one?
There you go.
It's identified by regulation. We've actually identified a few more we want to add to the list. In the past, when it had its own dedicated funding, because we had some people didn't want their highway added to the Alaska highway system. They felt they'd get a better shake in the CTP program. And you can see here, it had almost five times as much money. But basically, it's a highway that is connecting community to community primarily.
Okay. Thank you. I'm sure.
Follow-up, Senator.
I guess just out of concern from communities, and I know you get this all the time, but your department adds a project into the STIP, and then all of a sudden we're looking at the list, and it's not in the STIP anymore. It just kind of disappears. I know that confuses a lot of city councils and assemblies and city managers. I think it behooves you people to let us know or let the communities know that that project's going to come off the stip. When you're just casually looking at projects and, gee, it's not there anymore, you know, and then we get phone calls and then we have to call you.
Through the chair, Senator Egan, we've actually published an appendix in every STIP and every STIP amendment that explains why projects moved on or off.
But you should tell the municipal or the municipality you did it. It's not good nature to be looking at the STIP and all of a sudden saying, whoa, it's not there anymore. What happened? It happened to my community. And one more thing, you're talking about giving things to people. In Southeast Alaska, including Representative Wilson's community, my community, we got harbors. The state gave us their harbors, but we got them for 10 cents on the dollar, and the harbors weren't improved. So we're spending money trying to improve our municipal harbors. So sometimes it seems like a great thing, but a lot of times it's not.
Through the chair, Senator Regan, I'll take that under advisement. I don't actually deal with the harbor program.
You're lucky devil.
But I do know that 50% sharing is written in statute.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions, two different areas. One, when we're developing our 2014-2017 STIP, I'm wondering if we've done a financial analysis of how much we've committed the state to in projects and whether we will not advance more projects because we need to complete the ones that are on the books so that we don't have to pay back funds if we're not able to complete the projects. So as the alternatives come forward on some of these projects, if they give us a path forward and the state doesn't have enough money to finish those projects, what are we going to do?
Senator Faircloth,
do you know what I'm, you know?
Yes, I do. That's the very thing we're doing right now. We're making some progress. We know what can be delivered by the regions, and we're just to this morning we were working in the spreadsheets, and we hope to have something for the committee sometime this session. And and actually what we have done, we've separated the NHS out of the STIP, and we're going to address that separately. Then we'll address the STP separately, and I think it'll be more understandable. And we're getting there, and we will be talking to you about that.
Okay, follow up,
Madam Chair. I just wanted to make sure, from a financial perspective, the Finance Committee is interested in how we've committed ourselves on some projects because, you know, we're looking at cash flow and want to make sure that we can meet the obligations that our departments are negotiating issues for on behalf of the people of Alaska. So I appreciate that we'll see that analysis soon. My second question, and I know that I brought this up in a meeting with some of your staff, and that's about mobilization and demobilization of projects, specifically in rural Alaska or in communities that are harder to reach. And some of those costs are actually huge impacts on projects. And so I didn't know if there's a way to coordinate where state money is going to outside of DOT. So the issue was we're going to be in some smaller villages putting in, as an example, elementary schools. And there might be the need to build a road in that same region at the same time, as well as look at a port issue in that same community. But they're timed out differently, so we have three different projects that the state is carrying mobilization and demobilization costs on. And so I'm wondering if there's a way to align some of that to increase local hire in those communities. And so when I'm talking mobilization and demobilization, for those that might not be familiar, if I have to bring an asphalt equipment into a smaller community, I don't want to put those back and forth on a barge multiple times to come in for the elementary school, for the road project, and for the port project. If we could do all the asphalting at one time for areas other than DOT, it would be helpful to reduce those contract costs. And I'm wondering if at least we're talking about it.
Senator Faircloth, that's difficult for us. the projects that go into education and the local projects go through a different system, and we don't coordinate very well with the Department of Commerce and then even the district allocations by the legislators. We were just talking about this very thing yesterday with Lake Penn Borough representatives, and the mobilization is killing us. And we're looking for solutions on that. I think that's an excellent idea, and I would welcome some way to coordinate that. And we will consider that.
Madam Chairman.
Go ahead, Representative or Senator Fairclough.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman from the Senate side of the House, maybe we could, in your capacity as chairman, issue a letter to the Department of Education and the Department of Commerce asking for consideration on some of this consolidation. I understand that we've created silos both through policy and through past practices on how we do things, and I certainly don't want to affect the procurement side of the House where we have contractors and other people out competing for projects. But once those projects are awarded, it might be possible to include in the bid process a way to negotiate some of those costs down, and that we would go into a second phase after the contract was awarded to negotiate some of the demobilization and mobilization costs so that we could coordinate projects. So my suggestion is that either as individual chairman or as joint chairman that we issue a letter asking for some of that cooperation, because in these smaller communities it is really, it could do an entire other project for that community if we weren't moving equipment back and forth. Thank you.
And I think that's an absolute excellent idea. And since you're on finance, I do want to make a comment too. When we do projects, especially if it's for the community, I would like to have, you know, the Rasmussen Foundation, the 4-Acre Group, there's several groups now that have learned that before they do a project, they want the community to get very involved, and they want to know if the community can handle it, if they'll be able to keep with upkeep and maintenance. And I think that maybe the state needs to do that on their projects so that we know that we're not going to do something that the community can't even keep it up. And I think that's something that we need to look at that we haven't been doing. We know they've asked for it, they want it, and we automatically give it to them, and we don't always have, we really don't know whether they can sustain it. And so I think that's just something really important. But Representative Isaacson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, it's a clarification. What Senator Fairclough had mentioned is actually within our power right now. It's an allocation request from the University Regents for $500,000 over a three-year course for adding to the GINA program, the Geographic Information Network of Alaska at UAF. It's a MAFC project, Mapping Alaska for Self-Supporting Economies. It's so that these type of projects, whether a school is being built or, as you're saying, the DMOB-MOB, it's a tool for us also to be able to see. But as various people are going to a community, you can click on this map because we have all this data available. And you can see all the other projects going on if everyone, Commerce and DOT and DNR, if everyone is keeping their database up to date. This information is easily collated, and it's like Google mapping it. You can click on a community, see the projects, and you can then begin to put these pieces together. You'll be able, conceptually, you'll be able to see when a project is slated to be started, who the contractor is, and et cetera, who the agency involved is. This is a very excellent program. GINA gets, right now, they have one request per second on average to include information from their maps already into other people's maps. So this is a tool. It's an excellent idea. It's a tool that's already being developed, and so we can use that to get greater distribution and recognition for it. But exactly what you're asking for, in a very simple way, it doesn't deal with the sustainability side like you're addressing, but it does talk about the budgetary considerations and how we can bring down costs and avoid duplication.
Okay, follow up on that comment, Senator Fairclough.
Madam Chair, specific to that, that might be a project for the Finance Committee to consider, but my thought was that if you were to write letters together, that it would be on the procurement side so that we would create flexibility, because the legislature has created silos in some of these departments and their ability to communicate as well as coordinate. And so if we've created barriers that need to come down, I was thinking that procurement and being able to negotiate in the second round for some kind of regional coordination to reduce these projects might be a way to go forward. But again, we might need to bring either finance or transportation or somebody before us in the form of DOT, the Department of Education, and Commerce, who are issuing some of these grants. And then it goes to your point, Madam Chairman, that there isn't an analysis done on project worthiness and readiness to sustain a project. Sometimes you bankrupt people by giving them what they want because they can't go forward and actually sustain the actual project and being able to turn the lights on and pay for the operating costs after the state has provided the capital costs for an item. So I think that your point is spot on.
Okay. Senator Egan, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. Well, we have gone through our whole presentations today and really appreciate the information that DOT has given us. It's really going to help us when we think about what's going on finance-wise, or DOT-wise anyway. So thank you, Jeff and Pat. We really appreciate you taking the time to inform us. And we will, this is only Tuesday.
Yeah.
On Thursday, we're going to have individual meetings because we have bills that we're going to be bringing up on Tuesday or Thursday, and that's House Bill 260 and House Bill 271, the Railroad Feasibility Study and the Commercial Vehicle Exceptions. So having said that, we will adjourn. Thank you.